April 16th, meeting of the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules to Order. Good morning, members. Hope everybody got a lot of rest this weekend. I know we had a very strenuous week last week. And I'll open a work session on House Bill 2085. Mr. Stembridge.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2085 adds $1 to the fees required for recording a document with the county clerk, of which half is dedicated to local records management, half to the Secretary of State's Public Records Management Assistance Fund. And this bill also establishes the Secretary of State's Public Records Management Assistance Fund. It directs the State Archivist to award grants and provide technical assistance to political subdivisions for public records management programs. It creates a five-member Public Records Advisory Committee within the Secretary of State's office. You have the -2 amendments from Representative Cameron, which exempts annual recordings filed to maintain mining claims. And you have the -3, which committee staff compiled from information from the Secretary of State and State Treasurer, changes the membership of the proposed Public Records Advisory Committee by deleting one city clerk and adding one special district member. It specifies the county portion of fees to be deposited in a fund dedicated to archives, and it clarifies the fee deposit language.
So how many sets of amendments are there to this bill?
We had a -1, but we failed to include the treasurer's requested change to deposit. So there are two amendments for your consideration.
Okay, so the -1s were replaced.
Yeah, the -3s replaced the -1s.
Okay.
It's just the -2s and the -3s that are in under consideration for today.
Okay, and we are in a work session, but did we have people who needed to speak about this?
The -2 arrived from Representative Cameron. I think you have individuals in the audience who would be willing to speak on the -2.
Okay, please come forward. And if you could identify yourself and just briefly explain why we need this amendment.
Yes. My name is Tom Quintal. I'm a small claim owner and have multiple mining claims in Oregon. And while I don't speak for the 20,000 miners that do have these claims in Oregon, there's been a lot of discussion, and I believe in some of the handout information, a few petition signatures supporting the idea of including this amendment in this bill. I'd like to just speak directly to the amendment. I know when this bill was drafted, there probably was not consideration taken for any discrimination with any Oregon citizen in Oregon. The small-scale miner is the only one that we can find so far, talking with the county clerk recorders, that are required to file an annual proof of labor affidavit with the clerk every year. And if we do not, we lose our claim, our property. And they have determined that there shall be no tax, of course, on a mineral claim in Oregon. So that's one of our main concerns, is that it's not an option. If you get married or you do a real estate transaction or whatever, that's an option. We have no option or we lose our property. So we feel it discriminates, basically, against that class of citizen in Oregon. I guess I would say this, that in fairness, we're dealing with the Ethics Commission or Committee here, and I'm thinking you'll be fair and allow this amendment to be added. I don't know what else I can add to it other than if you have any questions regarding this issue, I'd sure be glad to answer them.
Okay, any questions for this witness? Yes, Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Excuse me, I maybe failed to mention too, and I thought I did, but this is an annual requirement. Did I mention that? I thought I did.
Right.
Now, we aren't asking to be excluded in this particular bill. Like if we file a new claim, whatever the fees are, taxes, whatever, we're willing to pay that. If we sell our mining claim, we're willing to pay that. The only exclusion we're asking for is the proof of labor affidavit that's required annually. That's the only thing this amendment refers to. That's it.
Okay. And this is the Dash 2 amendment.
Dash 2 amendment.
Okay, Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wonder if you'll help educate me in terms of the mining laws. $125 worth of labor shall be performed, and that's a ongoing requirement.
With BLM.
Yeah, if I continue just for a few minutes.
Go ahead.
Is a property tax charged to a mining claim?
There isn't a property tax. What it is, it's a federal tax that we pay. We also pay a fee to DEQ, a permit, if you will, fee. If we have equipment that exceeds the $14,000 threshold, then we pay a property tax on that equipment. So it's not like you're skating off here, no tax, because you're getting a user fee, you know, plus your recording fees, plus your assessment fees with BLM. So yeah, you are taxed, if you will.
And what's the different sizes of mines? They go from what size to what size?
Usually you have a minimum of a 20-acre claim per individual, mm-hmm. and you can go up to 160 acres with 8 locators on a mining claim. It becomes an association claim. So it... And another issue I probably should mention, we do have out-of-state... holders of mining claims in Oregon, and they have no representation, of course, in Oregon for their holding. So most of these claims are small claims, individual placer claims, some hard rock claims, but in any event, they still are required annually to file this affidavit. And I think bare bones, that's the issue. It's the annual ORS 517-210 is the Oregon statute that requires you to file this affidavit. And again, if you don't, you lose your property. Simple as that.
One final question?
Yeah, follow it.
How does one make a mining claim? What is the process in doing so?
Well, primarily what you do is you are on a stream, for example, if it's a placer claim, and you find some prospecting that paid off as far as color and this type of thing, or if it's a hard rock mine, and you find a load that has gold that may contain in the quartz or whatever, then you would say, well, using the prudent man rule, would this be economically feasible for me to mine this particular piece of ground? At that point, then you file what we call a notice of location. Now, here again, that notice of location is not what we're asking for an exemption for, and not at all. You'd file a notice with the county clerk. Okay, you'd pay that fee, whatever it is. Then you would file your paperwork with BLM. That runs about $170 on a new mining claim, including everything. At that point, if there are no conflicts with BLM on that claim, then you basically have that property. And that is not your land. It is only your mineral property, which has been determined in court to be a property right. And I think that's what we're really concerned about here, is that you can lose that property right if you don't follow the state law that's been handed down through the legislature. So,
Representative Roblin.
Thank you. A couple questions. The first one, thank you, Madam Chair. This is almost exclusively on federal land.
It is. Most, yes, I would say so. Most.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. Number two, you're asking to not have this fee. Does this Dash 2 eliminate all the other fees you have to pay annually, or is it just this $1 fee?
It's $1. Now, I knew you were going to bring that up.
You're still paying a lot of fees every year.
Yes, you are.
Okay.
What we have currently in legislation right now, and you're probably familiar with what's going on with Senate Bill 38, which they are wanting to add another $15 to this recording fee. We have House Bill 2857, which wants to add another $3 to this fee. And that's a total of $19. So you say, well, it's only a dollar. What's the big deal? Well, it's the accumulation. And one thing I didn't speak to is back in 1999, they put an $11 increase. Now, the recorder gets $5. And the rest of this money, he's kind of like a little tax collector for the Department of Revenue. And they then disperse it wherever it goes, which in the past they've been testifying against being asked to collect these fees, because basically fee-for-service is what they're supposed to be doing. It's a total of $19 that we're worried about here. In 1999, we were kind of asleep at the switch when this first one came through, and we said, this isn't going to stop. It's just going to continue to go. And if we had an option not to do it, that would be one thing, but we don't, or we lose our property. And so that's our concern.
So currently, how much do you pay annually?
For fees currently?
Yeah.
And this is something I'm researching right now. I believe in Marion County it runs about $26. In Baker County, I think it's around $24. I have claims in Douglas County, and it's $16 down there. And I can't understand, if they're only supposed to be charging $5 for their fee for service, why there's such a big spread in the dollar amounts that have been added. And so I'm going to be checking with the County Clerks Association to find out why there is this, what gave them the authority, if you will, to raise that fee that much in certain counties. It doesn't make sense. I'm investigating that right now.
I guess my question would be, does $1, this is a $1 a year fee, does that really make much difference?
It does, because it's like the $11 fee, and it's like the total accumulation of $19 that we're concerned about. And while there's no guarantee that all these bills are going to pass, there's a good likelihood, because I've been sitting in on work sessions for Senate Bill 38, and there's some pretty powerful lobbying going on with the low-income housing groups to get that bill through. And whether that starts now ethically back in the House like it should have under, I think it's Article 4, Section 18, where revenue bills are supposed to start on the House, not the Senate side. Been watching that one really close, so I'm really concerned that we get a total accumulation at the end of the legislative session of $19, not $1, but $19. So I can't just sit back and say, well, $1 is insignificant. It isn't.
So are you asking to be exempted from all the others, too?
No. Well, yes. And all the other where an annual no-option requirement is made by the state of Oregon, or lose your property. Yes, we are. We have amendments in all three bills currently, yes.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony.
You bet. Thank you.
Is there anyone else that wishes to speak on this matter? Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Roland, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Beth Hergert, and I'm the state archivist, and we're the ones that are proposing this bill, and we are in favor of the Dash 3 amendments. We worked with the clerks and the treasurer to get those amendments through. I understand the frustration in the Dash 2 amendments with the annual renewal, although this fee is different than other fees, and this helps the county clerks to manage those records that are requiring to be filed by everybody, because they're responsible for maintaining those records until the retention and disposition has been met. So they are responsible for the storage of those records and the maintenance of those records and the disposition of those records until they're finally met. We are amenable is to hearing the amendment in that if they paid when they first file and they pay when they relinquish their claim, then I suppose that's better than nothing. But the clerks still are responsible for managing all of that information that is being submitted. And we would just, again, like to say that this bill is meant to help the county clerks and all local government in the way that it's administered to manage all of this information that they're required to keep and maintain.
So I'm not clear. What is your position on the Dash 2 amendment?
Probably neutral. I can see their point in that they're the only ones that are required to do it, although in defense of the county clerks, they are responsible for maintaining that information, too. So it's not like they do that without cost to the clerks.
So you don't think that this would unleash a flood of other people lining up to try to get exemptions?
I unfortunately do see that happening.
Other questions for this witness? Okay, thank you very
much.
Members, we are in a work session, and I will recognize Vice Chair Berger.
Madam Chair, I move the dash 2 amendments be the Langton dash 2 be amended to House Bill 2085.
Representative Berger moves the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2085. Please call the roll.
President Roblin?
This is a hard one. No.
President Thatcher?
No.
President Berger?
Aye.
President Blessing?
No.
President Esquivel?
No.
President Hunt?
Excused? No. Motion fails. Okay, Vice Chair Berger.
Madam Chair, I move the dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2085.
Vice Chair Berger has moved the dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2085. Is there discussion?
Yes.
Representative Roblin.
If this fee was not going to pay the recorders to keep recording the things and keeping track of it, I probably would have voted yes on the other. So if we get any other fees, I think these people should be exempt. And I would not be opposed to looking back at some of the other fees that we're adding and see if there should be an exemption, because I think they have a real argument for annual fees as opposed to anybody else in this particular situation.
Right.
So I would definitely look at the others. This one actually has some direct relationship to keeping their filing and making sure that they have the right to keep their claim. So, and it is recorded. The others, I'm concerned, and I wish they had been here when they started making the $11 fees and these other kinds of things, because I think they are a unique situation in that they're paying annually. And I don't know of any others either, so there may be some. But from my perspective, other than the $5 recording and this $1 one, I'm not sure that the other fees that they're already paying are the kinds of things that should have to be done. So I would certainly look very kindly to this kind of amendment on any other kind of fee bill. The only reason I didn't hear was strictly because this one actually does help them maintain their record. If they ever had a case, we have the history of when they were there, and this is part of that. But the others, I have a hard time understanding why a person that has to pay every year would have to do it. So that's my comment.
We are in the dash 3 amendments, I'll remind the members. I do want to mention as well, too, that I think this bill has a ways to go before it is through even this chamber. It's got to go to Ways and Means after it leaves here. So is there further discussion on the dash 3s? Is there objection? Case seeing none, amendment is adopted. Vice Chair Berger.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2085 as amended with the dash 3s to the floor without recommendation as to passage, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Vice Chair Berger moves House Bill 2085 as amended to the floor without recommendation as to passage, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Discussion? Please call the roll. No.
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Excused.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. And members, I will close the work session on House Bill 2085. Members, we, because of the way our hearing was posted today, cannot take up the next bill until 9. So perhaps we'd like to get a cup of coffee. And please
coffee
join us at 9 o'clock. We are in recess.
Recess time.
And we have actually delayed our start for this hearing so that we could hear from a witness who has now joined us. And I also see Representative Shields in the audience. And so, Representative Shields, why don't you come forward? Good morning. Welcome to the Elections Committee.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chip Shields, State Representative, District 43, North and Northeast Portland. Colleagues, in the 2006 election, voters sent a message. They sent a message that they wanted greater transparency in elections finance. They sent a message that they were tired of having their votes diluted by big-moneyed interests. And even though they did not vote to change the Constitution to allow campaign finance limits through Measure 46, nonetheless, they voted convincingly for the reforms embedded in Measure 47. Voters passed Measure 47 with a clear 53% to 46% vote, and House Bill 3282 mirrors the reforms embedded in Measure 47. Not 37, 47. It will require better reporting. It will require that special interests let voters know who's funding a campaign, whether it's out-of-state corporate interests, a labor union, or a candidate self-financing their own campaign. It's about providing more information to voters. It's also about following the money. It's about protecting the public interest. And at the end of the day, House Bill 3282 is just plain good for democracy. So let's begin to restore the idea of one person, one vote. I would urge you to support House Bill 3282 today. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Shields. Any questions? I don't see any. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Okay, I'll call Dan Meek. Please come forward. Good morning. I know you weren't able to be here when we heard this bill before, so we have rescheduled it so you could testify. Welcome to the Elections Committee.
Thank you very much. And I appreciate the second bite at the apple here. My name is Dan Meek. Here I am representing Fair Elections Oregon, which is the organization that pursued both ballot measures 46 and 47 in the last election. And as Representative Shields indicates, 47 did pass. It's currently in litigation. That is, the Attorney General has decided that a portion of Measure 47, Section 9F, is actually its own poison pill that subsumes the entire bill and makes it dormant until the Constitution is amended. That certainly wasn't the intention of the drafters, and I don't think it's the legal effect either. So we're currently in Marion County Circuit Court on that issue, and of course we're asking the courts to require both the Secretary of State and the Attorney General to enforce all of the provisions of Measure 47, because none of them have been ruled unconstitutional by the courts. You know, the way the system is supposed to work is the legislature or the people using the initiative process pass a law. That is the law until some court at least says that it's unconstitutional, and no court has said that any part of Measure 47 is unconstitutional. So we expect that litigation to continue. In the first paragraph of my written testimony, I indicate where all the briefs are available online. And we think we've got a pretty good shot at maintaining the constitutionality of all of the provisions of Measure 47. But the subject of today's hearing, I think, proceeds on the assumption that the numeric limits in Measure 47 would not survive Vannetta versus Kiesling. We think they probably would survive, but let's assume for a moment that they wouldn't. The purpose of this bill is to implement the parts of Measure 47 against which there are no credible constitutional arguments at all. And your bill, 3282, has incorporated some of those provisions of Measure 47, but there are others, and I list in my testimony six other provisions for which there could be no credible constitutional challenge that were adopted by the voters as part of Measure 47, but are not included in House Bill 3282. The first one is probably the most important one, and that is Section 3E. It forbids a political committee from making a contribution to any other political committee. Instead, it allows a political committee to contribute only to candidate committees and to political parties. And right now, I'm sure you know that even with the revised system of campaign reporting maintained by the Secretary of State, it's very difficult sometimes to determine where the funds for a particular candidate comes from. Because if you look at look at what's reported online or on paper, you find that much of the funds come from political committees, many of which have quite euphonious names that don't indicate who's actually providing the money for them. Then you look up the reports of the political committees. There's a very small amount of that online now. It's only the amounts that were contributed or expended after January 1st of this year. So you go through the laborious process of looking at those political committees, and you find, lo and behold, many of them, primary source of money or contributions is other political committees. And so you have to dig down many layers in order to determine where the funds are actually coming from. With this, what Section 3E would do is forbid all of that and indicate that a political committee can either contribute to a candidate committee or to a political party or can make independent expenditures, and that's it. That's not included in House Bill 3282. The second provision that I pointed out is Section 4B, which requires that a candidate who spends more than $5,000 of personal money on a campaign for public office has to disclose that in every subsequent campaign ad, and you have included that in section in the bill, but also must report this within 3 business days. That's in order to trigger the provision that requires subsequent ads to include the disclosure. So I think that needs just a technical correction to add the additional reporting requirement. Third is section 8B1, which is another rather technical provision that requires that that campaign contributors, over, of course, the threshold amount, report name, residence address, year of birth, occupation, and employer. Currently, there is confusion sometimes among donors because they have the same name. Sometimes they're often father and son, for example. Can't tell who they are without their date of birth since they have the same name and sometimes the same address. In addition, the current law requires the reporting of only the occupation or the employer, but not both. The fourth item is Section 7D, which requires that any solicitation for contributions directed to employees of a corporation or other business entity must state there is no required contribution, that the employee's response shall not affect the employee's employment. Under Measure 47, there is a specific civil cause of action for a violation of this statute, and that provision, 7D, has not been included in House Bill 3282. The fifth section I identify is that campaign contributions is 9C. Campaign contributions not used in the campaign shall revert to the state treasury to pay for the voter's pamphlet. But a candidate elected to the Oregon legislature may deposit up to $10,000 of the unexpended funds into the legislative office account. This prevents the accumulation of war chests and really is sort of a truth in political spending provision. If a person or entity contributes to the election of a candidate, those funds should go to elect the candidate and should not go into a war chest that is eventually used to elect other people, support or oppose the election of other people.
And Mr. Meek, is that at the end of every election cycle, the balance of every campaign would go into this fund?
That's right. I believe that the calculation is done 30 days after the end of the general election, or in that neighborhood. And finally, Section 10D establishes an entirely new procedure for the following and resolution of election law complaints, requiring a prompt hearing before an administrative law judge and the opportunity for either party to appeal that decision to the Court of Appeals. Currently, there's no deadline for the Secretary of State to resolve any election law complaint. I'm personally aware of complaints that I believe are baseless, that have been outstanding for over a year, and that's just from my personal knowledge. I don't know. Perhaps there are complaints outstanding for many years. While such complaints are pending, the opponents, of course, are able to smear the target of the complaint with the statement that he or she is under investigation for campaign finance law violations, whether or not there's any basis whatsoever to the complaint that was made. So it is an important provision to have a deadline on the Secretary of State for resolving election law complaints instead of letting them hang around for years at a time with no resolution. Finally, I refer to the incompletely included provisions, and that is the handle provisions of Measure 47. You do attempt to include those in 3282, but 3282 doesn't actually define handle and actually doesn't indicate what the handle registration would consist of. So I would suggest that you adopt the definition from Measure 47 which indicates that it is a simple, unique combination of letters and numbers for each registrant, that is the individual's initials and a number, and that you apply it to, as Measure 47 does, to all contributors of over $500 in a year. The House Bill 3282 applies it only to out-of-state contributors. However, there are in-state, of course, everyone who is an Oregon registered voter already has a unique identification provided by the Secretary of State in the form of the voter registration number. However, not all contributors of funds to Oregon political campaigns are registered voters. And so if you don't apply the handle requirement to in-state residents on the basis of residency, not on the basis of registered to vote, then you will be leaving out some folks and I think defeating the purpose of the measure of the provision. And the purpose of the provision is really to make contributions easier to make and make them easier to track. If I have a unique handle, like DWM52, all I need to do is write on the check, DWM52, that's my handle, that's it. I don't need to write down my address, my occupation, my employer, my date of birth, or anything else about myself. All I have to do is write down that one little number. In addition, this enables the campaign finance reporting system to avoid a current problem, which is that persons who contribute with slightly different names are not accumulated or not put together in the reporting system. For example, I might be listed in some reports as Daniel Meek, in some reports as D.W. Meek, in some reports as D. Wilson Meek, etc. And the current system does not have a means for determining whether all of those three names are or are not the same individual. And so this would solve that problem. And that's about it. And I appreciate the intent of of House Bill 3282, including the provisions from Measure 47, against which there really are no credible legal challenges.
And to go back to item number 3 for a minute, mm-hmm. Your point about requiring both the occupation and the employer, I think we've now been required to supply both in our reports. So is that was not the result of a change in the law?
The law currently states that you must report. Of course, you can't report in some cases if it's not provided. Then you have to send out a letter, and maybe a letter comes back, and maybe it doesn't. You do have to report occupation. However, if you look at the definition of occupation, it says that you can either report what you do or you can report the name and address of your employer. Hmm. So currently it is really an either-or, although the employer part of it is buried in the definition of occupation.
Okay. Yes, Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I read 3282, if I were doing a campaign and I had a video made that was going out on television, I would be required to update that every day that it was being printed, because I have to put on there the top five contributors within the last 5 days. Is that true in the reading? Okay. How do you read that?
Representative Roblin, that requirement is only applicable to independent expenditure campaigns and not to the campaigns of candidates. So if the ad is paid for from your candidate's committee, then that's not required. In fact, under Oregon law, there is no identification required on such an advertisement.
It does not change that.
Right. The only requirements applicable to such an advertisement for identification are federal law, which require that it be identified. But this only applies to independent expenditure campaigns, and only independent expenditure campaigns above a certain threshold. And yes, every week or so, they would have to, if the names of the top five dominant contributors have changed, then they would need to change the disclosure.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Yes, Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Meek, on the provision concerning employers pressuring employees to contribute, some would say that there's already existing law on that. And how would you respond to that?
There is existing law on that. I may have mentioned that in my testimony, or I may have taken that out. There is an existing provision that essentially has the same prohibition, that no one may either offer a benefit or a detriment or employment in exchange for making a contribution. First of all, the existing prohibition doesn't apply to independent expenditures. It applies to contributions. So one might pressure someone into making an independent expenditure under existing law without penalty. And number two, under existing law, it is the only enforcement mechanism for that particular provision is a criminal prosecution by the Attorney General. It is defined as a Class C felony. Under the provisions of Measure 47, such an incident would give rise to a civil cause of action by the victim of the pressure. And we put in there quite a high penalty of $50,000 per violation, civil penalty, in order to make that practice very undesirable and very risky on the part of the employer. The employer, I don't think, would want to take a risk of doing that, because any employee could essentially bring a civil cause of action. And it doesn't have to wait for or rise to the level of a criminal prosecution by the Attorney General, which I think would be extremely rare.
Thank you.
Yes, Vice Chair Berger.
Thank you. Mr. Meek, your Section 5, the campaign contributions, not used, the war chest provision?
Yes.
Don't you think that the philosophy behind that is very contrary to what I think is the hydraulic that I would like to see encouraged and the hydraulic that I would like to see discouraged? And I think you would agree that I, as a candidate, really value those people that write out those $50 checks to me, that are personal to me, that say, I support you, and I'm willing to invest in you with some of my hard-earned bucks. And then to turn around and say, oh, but if I get too many of them, they're going to revert to the state. I'm curious why you didn't write this to say it reverts back to those people, if that is a problem. And further, if I can keep talking here, uh-huh. Don't you think that the issue of the big contributions that is a more worrisome thing is better taken care of in your Section 1, which, you know, is also not in this bill, but which I think has great merit in terms of showing, you know, where the big bucks are coming from?
Vice Chair Berger, yes, I having the money revert to the donors would be a better idea. It's just that there are some administrative problems with doing that. For example, I assume that the funds would be returned to donors on a pro rata basis. So you have to do that calculation and then cut maybe several hundred checks or several, you know, even more, depending upon the number of donors to a particular campaign. Having just finished up a successful class action lawsuit against Portland General Electric, I'm an expert in the administrative costs of cutting thousands of checks and sending them out, and it's very expensive. So it might eat up the entire cost of the funds that are left over. So you're right, that would be a more desirable, those would be more desirable beneficiaries. And so having it essentially as cheap to the state, except for $10,000 into the legislative office account, is a shortcut. That's correct.
Go ahead.
Well, and I guess my problem with that whole notion is it if you had this in, it would be a discourager to those small donors. I mean, I can't – maybe I'm not as concerned about war chests as you are, but I am looking for ways to encourage small donors, and this is very contrary in my opinion, and I don't think we need to belabor it. It's not in the bill, but I don't like that idea.
Um, Yes, Vice Chair. The, of course, another provision in the bill was is the creation in the measure, Measure 47, is the creation of small donor committees. Under Measure 47, anyone can create a small donor committee that accepts contributions only from individuals and only in amounts of $50 or less per individual per year. Under Measure 47, those small donor committees are then, there's no control over how they spend the money. They could spend the money all on your candidacy, or they could spread it around and spend it on 5 or 10 candidates or whatever they would like to do, or make independent expenditures with it. So in the context of Measure 47, this is perhaps a little less disadvantageous than taking it out of context, without having the alternative structure of the small donor committee with unlimited opportunity to spend.
May I ask, yes, Madam Chair, is the small donor thing part of this bill?
It's not part of House Bill. No, it's not part of House Bill 3282.
So there are others. I kind of understood from your testimony that these are the omitted sections, but there are other apparently omitted sections. But they are part of the constitutional issue.
Vice Chair Berger, yes, they are somewhat involved in that. That is, what I think Representative Buckley and Shields have tried to do is take the provisions of Measure 47 that have absolutely nothing to do with limits. Numeric limits on political contributions. The provision about small donor committees is in Section 3 of Measure 47, which is the section on limits. And essentially it says that the limits on, there are limits on contributions to to regular political committees of $500 per individual per year, and a limit on a contribution to a small donor committee of $50 per year. The benefit of having a small donor committee is then that there aren't any limits on the funds coming out or how those funds are used, as long as they're used in political contests. The disadvantage of the political committee that accepts larger contributions is that there are limits on what can be done with those funds. That is, only X $1,000 can be contributed to a political party, only so many $100 or $1,000 can be contributed to a statewide race or a non-statewide race. So the concept of small donor committee is fairly tightly linked to the system of limits, and I'm sure that's why Representative Buckley and Representative Shields did not include it in this bill.
Thank you.
Other questions?
I guess I do have a question.
Yes, Representative Thatcher.
It's actually in the bill, and it kind of relates to, it's the employer thing, the $50,000 deal. Your section, or your number 4, section 7D, excuse me, and it is somewhat reflected in House Bill 3282, but I like some of the clarifications that you put in yours, the verbiage. I like that. Because it's less clear in the bill to me. And I wanted to ask the question if it's appropriate that the $50,000 would go to the employee or, you know, whoever's suing, I guess, rather than to the state. It just seems like you're almost setting up, because, you know, as well as there being unethical employers, there are also unethical employees, and it just seems like it's setting up, I guess, a perverse incentive to use that if you have a politically active person as an employer. Not that I would know anybody like that.
Representative Thatcher, I think you suggested that the $50,000 should go to the employee, and perhaps
it should go to
the state.
The state, rather than the employee.
That's also not a bad idea. Although the purpose of having a civil penalty that is payable to the victim is that it gives the victim an opportunity to bring the case. Anyone who brings a case like this can probably expect to lose their employment. So there has to be something there in order to overcome the natural tendency of an employee not to report the employer who does this, who exerts pressure in one way or another for a person to make a contribution. So perhaps not all of the funds should go to the employee. Maybe there would be a 50-50 split or something like that. That would be appropriate. But if there's nothing there for the employee at the end of the tunnel, then the employee is very unlikely to enter the tunnel in the first place, I think.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
May I ask
one more question?
Mr. Meek, as the person who I believe is the author of Measure 47, would you say that this bill, House Bill 3282, reflects all of the provisions of Measure 37 except for the Section 3 that you said subsumes the constitutional piece?
Mr. Berger, of course, success has many fathers.
Mm-hmm.
There's more than one of them in this room.
Okay.
The
shall we say three proponent who is publicly associated with. Is that better language?
Yes.
Thank you.
And I would have to answer your question. No. That is, the current version of House Bill 3282 does not include all of the provisions of 47 except the limitation sections in Section 3. If it were amended to include the provisions that are included in my testimony, I think then it would be fair to make that statement. Technically, it would still not be the case because there are provisions here and there outside of Section 3. But those sections really don't, in the absence of the limits in Section 3, those other sections don't really seem to have a purpose. So what I've tried to do in my testimony is point out the additional parts of Measure 47 that make sense standing alone without the limits in Section 3.
One more question.
Yeah, follow up.
Chair. However, the big enchilada in your testimony, if you ask me, is your first one, Section 3E. But that is from Section 3 and therefore excluded.
It is in Section 3, but it's not... Oh, Vice Chair. It is in Section 3, but it's not a numeric limit. So what the Van Atta versus Kiesling case in 1997 was about numeric limits on political contributions. So what I've attempted to do is point out the parts of Measure 47 that don't have anything to do with numeric limits, that have to do with the kind of limitations that the Oregon Supreme Court has never had a problem with, and those are reporting requirements and that sort of thing. I think I would agree that there is, that perhaps Section 3 could be considered a numeric limit of zero, that is a numeric limit of zero in transfers among political committees. But the concern of the Supreme Court in the Van Atta case was the opportunity for folks to make contributions in the first place. Implementing Section 3E does not affect the opportunity of anyone to make a contribution in the first place. It only affects what happens to the money after it gets to the first political committee. And then the question is, can it go to a second political committee, and then a third, and then a fourth, and a fifth? So this sort of limitation on the chaining of political committees is in the literature in the subject is not considered to be a numeric limit, so I don't believe it would be subject to question under Van Atta, although it is in the section 3 that generally deals with the numeric limits.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Well, thank you. Thanks very much for having another hearing on this. Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 3282? Okay, seeing no one, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3282. And
we are adjourned.
With nothing further to do, we are adjourned.